but is simulated, you know, grief and pain that you inflict on someone else.
Is it real?
Is it as tasty as the real thing?
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 137 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the lactose intolerancer.
I'm Sam, and I'm a pixel sniper.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is February 122018, exclamation mark. Before we start, we have a warning. Anything can happen on this show. There's going to be profanity and very confusing date formats.
Yes.
So if you get uncomfortable or confused about any of those things.
Also, was that exclamation mark a factorial symbol?
It's a factorial.
Okay.
Factorio.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's a real big, date today.
Real big simulation game. All right, what's in the news this week? For starters, this is a prime number episode. Congratulations, we made it to another one.
Excellent. Yep.
Great job, team.
This will happen again, probably.
All right, so we got two important things that we need to talk about, and I don't really know about either of them, and these topics were brought to me by my co-hosts, Adam and Sam. Yes. Okay?
What you got?
First, Tom Brady. Let's talk about the Brady situation.
So, love him, hate him. I don't actually give a crap personally. I also don't watch sports ever. But,
me neither.
A friend of mine recommended watching there's a documentary called Tom vs. Time. That's actually Facebook made, which I don't understand. it's six episodes and each one's like 15 minutes. And it's a really interesting dive into, it is about Tom Brady, but I think really on a higher level, it's just about essentially what is the cost of expertise and acquiring expertise. And what that looks like for, in this case, this guy who now is 40 years old and is, you know, out quarterbacking most people who are considerably younger.
He's outbacking them.
He is outbacking them.
Mm-hmm. He's like a fullback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I wanted to recommend people look at it because I think, you know, we talk about getting expertise on the show quite a bit and about how we all have our own pursuits when it comes to how much time we dedicate to, you know, trying to work on our craft or whatever else. And in watching this, you just realize that he says this one line at the beginning where he basically just says, if you want to beat me, you have to give up your life because that's what I've done. And I'm like,
yeah,
all right.
Except yeah, you right. can't because you're always going to be behind.
Yeah.
You have to give up your life and then wait for him to die.
Apparently.
Yeah, except that there's that thing where he did lose.
He did lose. Yeah. No, he did lose. Well, I think it's, that's totally correct. So there's one episode left.
There is a degree of randomness.
Out. Yeah. There's always randomness, but it's just a really interesting dive. And again, I know some people have very strong feelings about this. Who cares? But the whole point is just looking at someone who has actually just like really tried super hard to completely orient their life around this particular pursuit. And then what that means for him, what it means for his family and all this other stuff. And it reminds me, there's a book we mentioned in the podcast called Peak, as well as one called Mastery, which both are about acquiring expertise and the cost of it. And the bigger point with both in Brady's case in those books is that to have one expert in your group of people requires that everybody essentially signs on to allow that person to be an expert. Right.
Yep. Yeah.
Because they still have to, you know, like eat food or, you know, take care of their kids or pay bills or whatever else. And there's a lot of stuff that if other people aren't society willing to chip in,
society doesn't just let you do one thing.
Correct. And so if you want to do that, then you actually have to have a group of people who kind of supports you in that. So I'd recommend checking it out. Really quick episodes. And just very interesting.
This reminds me of there's this, this batsman from India, Sachin, Tendulkar.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known as sort of the greatest cricket batsman in the fucking universe. Mm-hmm. I think that was his official title in his business card.
Kind of a long title, but really good one though.
And there's this great documentary about this guy and how sort of he started playing when he was, I think, 16 professionally. And it was right around in the early 90s when India was starting to come onto the world stage. And so he sort of like carried the weight of the nation on his shoulders, like representing India internationally and all this stuff. And the whole country just is in love with this guy. And they showed sort of what his routine was when he was growing up. And it was that exact same thing where basically he would go out and he'd be playing cricket all fucking day. And he would just sort of make pit stops back at his house where his family would quickly like throw food at his face, you know, and they like give him whatever he needed. And then he would just kind of zoom back out the back door and go back and play again. And that was all he did just all day, every day. Mm-hmm. But he couldn't do that if he had, you know, if other people weren't there to support him and stuff. Right. So, you know, it's a thing.
Yeah.
So, and then Adam,
effort, weirdly,
you wanted to talk about the cost of organization.
Mm-hmm. I did. Well, so this weekend, there's been a big problem in my house, which is that we moved to St. Louis a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. We're closing in on 2 years now. I had a desktop PC, you know, before I moved. I just never put it back together. I don't have a desk in my new house.
Mm-hmm. Or a top.
So
it's just half nude all day.
I've just been working at our kitchen counter, or mm-hmm. kitchen table. I mean, or no, sorry, dining room table. All these rooms, so confusing. So I've just been working
houses, man. What are you doing, right?
So I've just been working at our living room table for the past year and a half when I go home. Which, you know, it's the wrong height. It's kind of a bummer. It's always then just shit all over the dining room. So then when people come over and I have to move my desk, you know, so it's
right. Yep.
Nothing about it is good. And it's been kind of a bummer going home and getting ready to sit down to work and then just being uncomfortable.
You got
to
do work before you can work right. to clear things out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just no good. And it's not my space and so on. So this has been true for a year and a half. But then finally I decided this weekend, I was like, it's time to not be doing this anymore. So that was the plan.
Was there some kind of an event?
Did you I just got tired enough, you know.
Okay.
It was just time now. And so we put a plan together. I was like, I need to get a desk, find a place to put it, measured out some stuff. I got a desk ordered, did all the things. I was like, all right, now time to get my PC put together. It's been in storage and parts for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Then I remembered, oh yeah, I got rid of my actual tower and I just have the parts because I didn't like my tower. And I was like, I'm moving. This is a good time to get a new one eventually.
So you just got parts.
So I just have parts. So I was like, all right, cool. That means I need to go buy a tower. And it turns out Jenny, my wife, also has a tower that she doesn't want because it's a fucking enormous. It's one of those crazy gaming rigs that's like eight feet tall.
I got one of those. It's got wheels. It's got wheels on the bottom because it's so big you can't. You got to wheel it around like a shopping cart.
That's extreme. Mm-hmm. So hers does not have wheels, which is a bummer because it's fucking heavy.
It needs wheels.
But it doesn't fit under her desk because it's at least 6 inches taller than the bottom of her desk. So she hasn't been using her desktop either. And so we're like, oh, this is stupid. Let's just go fix this. So we go to Micro Center. We get a couple towers. They're fucking spectacular. It's beautiful. Got like a window on the side, you know, but it's not like the gamer style where
gorgeous,
it's all glowing.
Wheels. Just four-wheel drive.
No wheel drive, unfortunately. But the idea was like it's sleeker, you know, it's sleeker and smaller, mm-hmm. you know. So we get these things, we get them home, we start putting them together.
Yeah. And nothing fits.
No. This was like it was this weird moment because this case was beautifully designed. It was like I kept on saying as I was doing stuff with it, I was like, it seems like they knew everything that makes putting a computer together a pain in the ass, and they tried to design around it.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the weird thing. It took me 3 hours to build my computer, when normally when I'm building a PC, it's like 20 minutes, right?
Right.
But everything felt like it was easier. So I was trying to figure out, I was like, what the hell was going on here? And it was actually because the way that they designed it was to sort of showcase kind of the innards, because it's got this little panel on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all about organizing. It's all about putting things, like tucking them away neatly, you know. And
you get your cables.
Yeah, so you get your cables, like you're like looping them around stuff.
Oh.
And like when you're putting in the power supply, you don't just like jam it in there and screw it in. There's like this little thing that you kind of take out and you put your power supply on that. And then you slide that whole thing.
You gently sort of.
Yeah, it's just, everything's just kind of gently finagled. Mm. And basically this kind of resulted in two things. One is it wasn't obvious how to do anything because there's like some stuff you're gonna have to move around and get it all to work properly. But as soon as you got it, it was like, oh, this is beautifully designed, you know, once you figured it out.
So it was almost like a fun puzzle.
Yeah. I mean, and it was, I had a good time, but like it burned my plan was for the day. I was like, I'm going to build this computer, get it ready to go. So when my desk comes, I can build that, be done with that. I'm going to go down to the basement, clean all that up. Mm-hmm. I was like, had this huge plan in mind. And then like 8 p.m. rolled around and we'd built these two computers over the past 4 or 5 hours.
Like, I got to go to bed.
Yeah, it was bedtime. You know, it was crazy, but it was because they had spent so much of the design efforts around carefully controlling everything and making it just perfect, you know, so it's a very controlled environment, that the cost of actually doing it was enormous. And it looks great now that it's done, you know, but shit, because the way that you normally put a computer together is you open up the panel, throw the motherboard in, fucking pile all the guts in, right? And then you're just like, cool, I'm done. And that's the end of the story because it's just all tucked away and hidden. The chaos is managed. And
yeah, that's the joy of having a tower that's the size of a walk-in freezer.
Yeah, you just throw everything in there.
You grab your motherboard like a Frisbee and you just kind of just fucking launch it in there.
And it just sticks wherever.
Wherever it goes, that's where it is now.
It was an interesting design problem though, because they put a window on that thing.
Yeah.
Now you have to care about the aesthetics of the inside of a computer that is under your desk.
Well, no, you don't. So mine has a window. Mm-hmm. And here's what you do. You get parts that have LEDs on it.
Right, so it just glows.
So that when you look into it, it's blinding.
But then you got that problem, which is if that happens to be in a room where you want to take a nap or sleep,
yep,
then it has that blue light situation. This happens
only
if
it's on. I mean, you could put that bad boy to sleep. You're good to go.
Sometimes they're very bright. They persist through death of the
computer. That is true.
You know what I mean?
Some of them are crazy bright.
That is true. I did own an upright fan that you know, like a standing fan in a room. And you could put it into sleep mode where it was like a very low, you know, calming kind of white noise thing. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the sleep mode had this fucking blinding LED on it that just, and it would always shine in exactly the direction the fan was pointing. And so if you want the fan to gently put a breeze on you while you're sleeping, you also have to be awake and blind.
Right.
So,
yeah,
you know, design, it's hard.
It is hard. But also, long story short, organization has a very high cost.
Well, it does. In this case, it's actually you suddenly were contending with an element of building a computer that you actually have not. You added an element. Yeah. It wasn't just putting a computer together. No. It was doing so beautifully.
Yeah, in a particular way.
Which luckily someone else laid out a plan. Because imagine if you're like, I'm going to do this myself. I'm going to make this look really good.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of effort went into designing that thing, definitely.
Maybe this is more of a parable of the cost of perfection.
I think so, too.
Yeah. I don't know, because I mean, I think about this like with my email inbox, right? Though I spend zero time managing it because it's just chaos. I don't have to. I just archive things and then search for them, right?
Mm-hmm. But it's useful chaos.
Chaos. It's chaos that doesn't have an impact. It's not useful chaos. It's chaos that doesn't matter, right? Which is the same as the inside of a computer, actually. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if there's chaos in there. And so recognizing when chaos is actually just fine versus when it needs to be wrangled and organized is important, because it always feels like you should organize the thing, you know?
But really, you should just hide it.
Yeah, you should just hide it.
Yeah, this reminds me of, I went and did my taxes last week, and I've been using the pile method for my file storage system now for the last year because I read Algorithms to Live By. And they said it's much faster to search than it is to sort.
Yes.
So I read that and I was like, sweet. That means I'm not actually filing anything. So I just have a pile. I just have a pile of papers in my closet from the last year. So I went through and I was like, all right, cool. I got to get all my tax stuff put together. Just went through the pile, literally 3 minutes, got everything I needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
So basically, anytime something came to you and you're like, this seems like a finance-oriented document.
I mean, there's finance stuff in there. There's health stuff in there. It's all just in this pile.
Right.
And then I just go dig through it and find the stuff and I'll move on.
Yep. Because you only need to search it once a year.
Exactly. I've spent no time maintaining it. Yep. It's literally a pile. It's incredible.
Now, here's a question. Once you're done with your taxes, can you just toss the remainder?
You got to keep those for 7 years.
Well, so here's what you
the
rest do. Of
the stuff that you didn't need for your taxes.
But his health stuff is in there too.
Yeah, there's just other stuff. There's other important stuff in there. But here's the other rule from searching, which is that things that are on the top of the pile, things that you've used most recently are also the things you're most likely to use again.
Yeah.
Right. So once you've sorted them out, they end up back on the top again.
Yeah, so now all those finance documents are on the top.
I've been doing it wrong the whole time.
Yeah, so what you can do is then just like every 7 years, just throw away the bottom third of the pile.
Roughly.
Then you're probably fine. Good. Actually, no, every 7 years, throw away the bottom seventh of the pile.
There you go.
Assuming that you're aggregating documents at a constant rate.
Which, I mean,
hope so.
Seems to have been my life experience. I guess it has accelerated a bit.
It's accelerated.
You would think it would go down since the internet, but no.
No, that just enabled people to send you more requests to print things.
Yes.
And then sign them and then scan them and then fax them back.
Yeah. For some reason.
If you do this, just fuck you. All right. Studio news. What happened last week? We sent out the very first ever B-Scotch Ballyhoo.
Yeah. So a few people, I think it should be, it's going out to a lot of people. I think it's
Manny.
They were like 65,000 as of this morning that it was sent to.
It's probably about half done.
It's about half done.
We did send it to an individual named Manny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
That's it.
Probably. I mean, just statistically speaking.
So there will be, if you haven't gotten it by the time the podcast, it should be coming in the next couple of days. It's random.
They'll probably all be out by the podcast, I bet.
I think so.
Yeah, so we included all kinds of beefy, delicious goodies in there, including our new Crashlands comic.
Yeah.
Which, if you haven't gotten the newsletter by the time this podcast comes out, or if you just unsubscribed, you can still get the comic, which is at bscotch.itch.io.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been getting a good response.
Yeah, it's been really good. And, I mean, it's a full... I think it's a 30-page thing so far. So there's the teaser in there, and then there's the first chapter. We have two more chapters that are getting put together. So we'll be putting those out with the next issues of the Ballyhoo as well. But yeah, it seems like the response so far has been really good. People seem to dig it.
Overall, we showed a little first look of Levelhead. We showed a couple of the buddies from Scuffle Buddies.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just dripping with tasty flavor. Yeah.
And we also introduced our abs.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, we have a new program called Abs, mm-hmm. which is sort of the sister program to Rumpus.
Mm-hmm. It's really, it's like the core strength of our studio.
Yeah. So Abs is our anti-bug squad, mm-hmm. which we thought, you know, whenever we need to test stuff, it'd be nice if we just had a pool of people who we could pull from regularly.
Instead of having to make a new beta every time.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we're developing a system, which is called the Abs, which is a curated group of people who have a wide diversity of gaming backgrounds and devices available to them and all this stuff. And so whenever we do a beta, then we'll ping people from this group, bring them in, have them test some stuff. And the reason that we needed to open this up is because Levelhead is now 6 weeks done with development. Yep. And it's reaching a sort of mechanical completion point. And up next is we have a few sort of UX user experience things to tweak, and then web features, and then we're ready for testing.
Yep.
So I mean, we're
it's
not
coming up.
We're not very far away. So we thought we should give people plenty of time to get signed up into the Abs,
mm-hmm.
So that when it's time to test, then we just have that ready to go. Mm-hmm. And I think our testing plan is we're going to do it in two phases, where the first test, and this is how we did it with Crashlands, which worked really well, mm-hmm. which was the first test was a very small group of like 10 to 20 people, where the goal there was to just find the most egregious problems.
Yes.
Both in terms of mechanics, gameplay, balance,
so as well as people bugs. Who were the most forgiving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who would then, when everything they worked so hard for just disappeared.
Yeah, and also knowing that most of the things that they produced or their save file or whatever would just be completely obliterated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Because there's no backwards compatibility. It's just madness.
Yeah, and so that's how we're going to do the Levelhead testing, where we're going to have a small group as our first wave of bug crushers.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll open it up for a much bigger beta. So that'll also allow us to kind of stress test some of our systems in a very small way.
Yeah, it won't actually be stressful for anything except for us.
Well, it's mostly going to be stressful from a user experience perspective, yep. of like, if we have a couple hundred people in a beta, and they're all building levels, and we're showing now mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds of levels instead of just a couple dozen.
How does that work?
How does that, is that going to actually work? Because
mm-hmm.
you can assume that if you get 1,000 levels into your system, and if that's still manageable and easy to sort through and stuff, then it's probably scalable enough that you're good. So, so that's how that's going. And then if you want to get into the Abs, then we have a bit.ly, which is bit.ly/powerfulbscotchabs. And there's hyphens between those words. So it's powerful dash bscotch dash abs.
Mm-hmm. Get in there.
Get in there. Get crunching.
Mm-hmm.
It's time
to crunch.
Oh, shit.
our abs will be crunching probably.
That's true.
Within a few weeks.
We actually do crunch during betas. Because we want everything to be good for people. So
yep. You got it.
This is getting more perfect.
You got to crunch those abs.
Also, someone noticed. So the Rumpus logo was also sent out in the Bscotch Ballyhoo. And someone noticed, and my wife noticed this too. She goes, now it's called Rumpus. The R.
Kind of
looks like a man who is like doing a, like bending his legs back and showing his ass for the rest of the word. And that's I looked at it and I was like, oh God, like it's true.
That's right.
Totally fine by me. Yep. There we are.
Yep.
Totally on purpose.
We're probably going to have
everything about just everything we're doing completely on purpose.
Yeah.
Fully designed.
And also, we have Rumpus, we have a Rumpus beta that needs to happen for the website as well.
Yes.
So we're probably going to have a Rumpus abs, mm-hmm. at some point.
That'll be before the game abs.
Before the game abs happens. Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of crunching, a lot of abs, a lot of Rumpus mm-hmm. in the next 3-4 weeks.
You know, probably. I like how these things just kind of work out.
Yeah.
You know, it's good.
All right. So before we get on to some questions from our listeners, let's quickly hit some industry news.
What you got?
All right. So we got two things. One, Loot Box Watch 2018.
It's happening.
For those of you who are regular listeners of our podcast, you will know that loot boxes are a thing we like to talk about because we think that this is a this is Gray Rhino mm-hmm. that's about to trample the shit out of
the industry as a whole. And no one's moving to get out of the way.
Nobody's moving to get out of the way. Basically, the problem is that there's a lot of money to be made if you basically turn your game into a casino.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's also maybe
questionable legality if you turn your game into a casino.
And so a lot of developers...
And if it isn't questionable, it's going to become questionable.
Yes. Right. And a lot of developers basically say, well, the thing is, it's very expensive to make games, so we have to basically build casinos. Our own personal Las Vegas mm-hmm. to bank all this shit.
Even though we decided the budget to make the game in the first place.
Right. Yep. Because... because as we know, when a game makes more money, then the company who makes the game staffs up and makes the next game more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then they had to buy up all the ad space, which then makes ads more expensive.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then everybody else has to compete for those same ads, which means they have to spend more money.
Right. But the problem is, since anybody can turn their game into a casino, then everybody can make a fuckload of money.
So it turns out Germany was like, this looks a little suspicious.
Didn't like this.
Yeah.
So they're opening up a commission to determine whether loot boxes are predatory towards children and whether it's legally counts as gambling.
Interesting. But like, why is it only towards children? You know, this is the thing that boggles my mind so hard is that...
Adam, we know adults are fully in control of their behavior. How many adults do you... Every adult I know is super well put together.
They're very resistant to gambling mechanics. Very thoughtful.
Yeah. I guess, you only see children that are addicted to gambling.
They really, I would...
Well, now anything, that I think about really.
It. Yeah. Whenever you go to a casino, there's a bunch of these toddlers just smoking, just rolling the slots.
It's a good thing we're protecting our youth from all these horrible things that all adults are just immune from. Yeah.
Now, I have to say, though, I do believe... that most things should probably be unregulated in general.
Yeah, real libertarian.
Not really, but...
I mean, that is the libertarian stance, I think, right?
I think the libertarian stance is just anarchy. Okay. Just burn everything down and you get a gun, I think.
But the state doesn't give you one.
You got to build it yourself. You got to build your own forge. You got to harvest your own... iron from the mineral nodes around your house.
And the house is something that you probably killed somebody else to get because the government couldn't have given you that
correct property. Yeah, actually, I think being a libertarian is probably a lot like PUBG.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah.
You just get thrown into the wilderness, mostly naked. And then,
it's like a crafting game.
And then once you've murdered 99 people, then you are now the king of nothing.
Until somebody murders you, though, because it's... Because
libertarian.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, what were we talking about? Oh, PUBG.
Yeah.
Let's transition over to this because I think this is an interesting tidbit of news, which is, so we're making Levelhead into a social game in the sense, not in like the Zynga sense, but
it's going to be blowing up your Facebook friends.
sense that the core of the game revolves around sharing levels with other people in the game.
And you're going to earn points with the more Facebook likes that you get.
Yeah. And we've always been hesitant to do anything with multiplayer because of cheating. Because everybody fucking ruins everything.
Yeah, so, the best example of this is we put basic leaderboards in, I think it was Red Rampage.
They all have them.
They all have them?
Okay.
Yeah.
All of our old games.
And within, I think, a day, someone had hacked it to say they were first place because they had the largest integer possible to be represented in code.
Yep. So you have like one person with 65,000 juice collected, and then the next person has like 90. So
pretty dumb.
Which we also know that which I don't know if we've ever told anybody, but in Roid Rage, it is generally impossible to get more than a certain amount of juice because the asteroid field gets progressively more dense.
It does.
As you acquire more juice. And I don't remember if I put a cap on that.
At some point, you will die.
I think at a certain point, you just die.
You're just dead. But there are all those power-ups that you can blow up asteroids and stuff, you know? So maybe...
I don't remember what the density is there.
Yeah. You're saying the whole point of this is that PUBG banned, what, a million players?
Over a million players in just January.
Okay, so...
This is a paid game. Like, you buy this game for, what, 40 bucks? 40 bucks or something?
Yeah. Although they did not say that all the people they banned were paying users instead of pirates. Because presumably pirates are getting in there. They just you can't keep them out, you know?
Yeah, presumably. I don't know. Yeah. I assume maybe they have the resources to do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I mean, if you think about...
Either way, it's a lot of...
They banned $40 million worth of sales of players.
Yeah.
in just January. They were banning over 33,000 players per day. And this actually, this is
crazy.
Kind of makes me think of, we had talked a while back about Jeffrey Lynn's GDC talk about League of Legends toxic community behavior, because they at the time were, you know, the most popular online game. Now it's PUBG. And they had that problem of it's a 5v5 game. And if one out of 10 people is a dick and somehow does something to ruin the game for other people, then most of the time your 5v5 matches are going to be ruined by somebody being a dick, right? And so PUBG is a 100 person free for all.
Yeah.
Which means
you get one cheater in there.
Yeah. If you get one person who's hacking using an aim bot or doing something to be able to teleport around the map or whatever, then that whole match is ruined
for 100 people.
For
99 people.
Well, if one person's having a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now it's more like, you know, with how many users they have, you know, it's more like probably a good 10% of their players are cheating at least. And so
it's crazy.
Yeah. So in any given match, it's almost guaranteed statistically that somebody's going to be cheating.
I still think they did it the wrong way, because what they should have done was every time they identified somebody as a cheater, put them on a different server with only cheaters.
Yeah.
It would have been beautiful.
Yeah. Don't ban them.
Yeah.
You just flag
give them a taste of their own medicine.
They can never again play with normal people.
Yeah. Just never. They can only play with other, because like, you just get to understand what it feels like. Well, all you feel is the power, you know?
Yeah, but also then you get to watch the arms race.
I know, which would be spectacular.
You
know,
because you get to see, because now you're only playing against other cheaters, so now you have to develop something even better.
Yeah, it would be amazing.
It'd be cool.
Yeah, and then you could then just put up like a Twitch channel that all it does is just spectate pure hacker matches, which would be really interesting.
Pretty magical.
Yeah.
Now, and this makes me think, what if you made a game where the point of it was to cheat? Mm. And then you wouldn't, it's like having a weed garden. Like, it's a way to shortcut the normal problems, right? So if you have a, and I'm not talking about weed. Like,
what are we talking about?
You have a garden, if you have a garden that's only weeds, then you never have to pull the weeds, right?
That's true. Weed is just a plant you don't want there.
Right, and if you want all the plants, then you've now shortcutted all of the landscaping you would have to do. So
you also do have a really ugly patch of ground, though, right?
Well, yeah, but that depends on your standards. You just got to lower your bar. So if you have a game that's an online multiplayer game, but you make it really, really easy to cheat, like real fucking easy,
you just type in console commands.
Yeah.
Everybody can just type in console commands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you make it so that cheaters don't have an advantage anymore.
Because
everybody's a cheater.
Right.
Right. And so now you don't have to ban anybody. You don't have to monitor anything. Mm-hmm. This is basically EVE Online, right? Yeah. Like, just take away all the rules and don't enforce anything.
When it comes
anything.
To cheating, it is all about, because it's like, you know, God mode style stuff. It's about shooting through walls. But if you just introduce those all as mechanics into a game, just take all the things that cheaters do and just have them be mechanics.
No walls. Everybody's invincible.
Yeah. Auto aim.
Yeah. That's,
it might not sell very well.
No.
It seems like there's a market of at least 1 million players who are looking for something like that, according to PUBG's ban list.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, if we just gave them that with then a whole bunch of AI players who weren't in God mode, right? So it wasn't multiplayer. It was just fake multiplayer. So that you come in, you play as basically a god.
You play as the cheat.
You play as the cheat, right? Everybody else is just a bunch of peons that you're just massacring. But this is the important part, is because your goal as a hacker is to ruin everybody else's day. It's not actually to win.
Right. So the other pretend AIs need to complain.
Yeah. They have to be real sad, you know? They have to be yelling at you constantly because like it's feeding your trollness, you know?
The robot players will say things like, I spent the last of my paycheck on buying this game.
Yep.
This
is my 1 hour of free time because I have 100 children.
Yeah.
The Troll Simulator 2018.
Yeah. And then maybe we can get all of the trolls and the hackers just to go play that and get the experience that they want anyway. Mm. And they can just leave the rest of us alone.
But is simulated, grief and pain that you inflict on someone else.
Is it real?
Is it as tasty as the real thing?
I don't think so. A problem.
You know? I don't know. Maybe you could play some goat MMO simulator and see if that tickles your fancy. Yeah. All right, let's get on to some questions from our players. These questions, I guess not all of them are players, but there are our podcast listeners. These questions come from podcast.bscotch.net. So if you'd like to get your question onto a future episode, get over there, put together there. All right. First question comes from Woland77. A lot of people have been saying that video games are too expensive to make, and much of the blame for this is pointed at hyper-realistic graphics. Do you think graphical fidelity is necessarily a bad thing in games, or is this just a bunch of loud noise?
Well, I think it's absurd to basically say... We can have a lot of graphics if we spend a lot of money.
A lot of graphics. A lot of graphics.
Yeah. So we have done this. Yeah, yeah. We only have it as a studio. We have something like a cumulative of like 20 graphics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like but, max, right?
Yeah.
But
Call of Duty has like 98 graphics.
Oh, yeah. Shit. Way more than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it costs like $1 million per graphic.
Per graphic.
Right? That's the thing. Yeah.
Which is actually why we only have like 0.5 graphics.
Yeah,
like
it ramps up.
I mean, it's an exponential
graphic. Yeah. Yeah. Okay,
so every additional graphic costs more than
actually,
the
it's true
because
it's
graphic.
An incremental gain.
Yeah.
But at an exponential cost. So now I'm Call of Duty, right? And I'm like, I want real fucking good graphics. Mm-hmm. I have to buy 1,000 graphics.
A thousand more graphics.
So I do that. And then I turn around and I say, I had no choice. But to spend all this money on all these graphics.
There's so many graphics in this game.
Yeah. So this was too much money. Mm-hmm. I feel bad about that.
Right. And now I have to put loot boxes in the game.
Yeah.
And the problem with those loot boxes is you have to put graphics on them.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah. And I have to buy at least another 2 graphics.
Horrible.
You know, it takes at least 2 graphics for a loot box. But it's
the absurdity of just like turning the blame around and saying, we couldn't help it. You know, like
you made us like this.
You somehow made us.
What is this?
Do
an
this.
Abusive relationship? Yeah,
well, no, I think this is gonna sound. This is gonna sound crazy. But
yeah,
I'm ready to say it. I have spoken with a large number of people who play video games.
Okay, how many would you say
who have literally said to me the phrase, "I only play games with really good graphics,"
mm-hmm.
right? Meaning they will only buy stuff that's like that is the cutting edge graphic.
Sure.
And they don't really put that much stock in the gameplay or the quality of the experience. It's all about, like, when I shoot something, do I see debris, you know, simulated?
Can I see a neuron?
Shoot
out of a head.
Yeah. Do I have a scope on my sniper rifle that is also an electron microscope where I can see, you know, down to the quantum level?
Right.
Because that's what the game is about for a lot of people, actually.
Well, I think that's the thing is actually there's a particular type of game that you play where graphical fidelity is really important. So look at like Mortal Kombat, for example. The fact that you can punch someone and then see their spleen rupture and their ribs get blown out inside their body.
Because that's part of the game.
It's part of the experience of like punching someone.
But
I would
argue that isn't super important because Mortal Kombat was a very popular, well-received game, you know, 30 years ago or
before
whatever.
It was X-rayed. But it also had... But they also had ridiculous graphics at that time as far as these, like,
I mean, they did. But I mean,
it was very high fidelity.
It was.
But
it
let's just say, though, that your argument is true, which is that players are demanding this. I mean, people gave it to them, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, like, whose fault is it still?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because capitalism, bro. Capitalism. If there's a demand for something, there will be a supply.
Yeah. Well, the other truth, though, is that it is true that making things with higher graphics or generally higher fidelity does cost more money.
Yeah.
It costs way more time, more money. And we experienced this firsthand with the Baconweed Fairy. We were making that for Crashlands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we put an extra graphic on that
one. Yeah, when we use Spine. And so Spine, for those of you who aren't familiar, it's a 2D animation engine that essentially lets you put bones into a 2D creature of some sort and then just wiggle the bones around and the body follows the bone.
Which this is how 3D animation works.
Mm-hmm. Same way. And so I think I ended up spending like 3 days animating this Baconweed Fairy, which prior to this, the maximum amount of time I'd spent animating something was maybe like 4 hours, maybe.
Yeah.
And yeah, it turned out really cool looking, but then for other reasons, we ended up not being able to use that actual animation in the game. And the thing is, people still talk about the Baconweed Fairy. They still enjoy the fact that this insane creature exists. It's not as smooth of an animation as it was in Spine. But the whole point is that like doing that extra bit, even just on the animation side with 2D graphics, was a tremendous blowout in terms of our overall time cost.
Yeah.
So it is definitely true that like the more graphical fidelity you have, the more work there is to do.
Yes. The more number of graphics there are.
Yeah.
So, here's the thing. It's not a bad thing.
No.
It's also not a good thing.
I'm just going to
take the libertarian stance here and just say people want graphics and they'll pay for those graphics.
Which is
and
true.
Companies have the graphics to sell to people.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So they're going to put those, they're going to take that graphics from the warehouse. They're going to put those graphics in their game. Yep. People buy it. That's just how the market is.
Everyone's happy more or less.
But I think it would be an error to say that your graphics are correlated with the quality of gameplay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also think
aspects of entertainment.
It's correlated with cost, but isn't the thing that determines cost.
Correct.
Because, you know, the companies making video games are just companies, mm-hmm. you know. Most of their costs are going to their CEOs. That's just how that works.
And
the rest CEOs, is going to advertising.
And the CEOs aren't putting any graphics in there.
I know.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah. What is that about?
It's pretty wacky.
We need to put these CEOs to work, have them put at least 3 or 4 graphics mm-hmm. in that game.
Yep.
My God. All right. Next question comes from Menelous. Hello.
Hey.
So
I hope you guys are doing well.
Yeah. I appreciate that.
So I listened to Audible's version of Anti-Fragile, and holy cow, was that some tough jerky to digest, which is a good thing. Any other books similar to that that I should listen to? Thanks again.
Similar to that. Yeah. And I will say, just for anybody who now decides to go listen to that or read that book, just remember, you just got to get past the author's self-absorption and obsession.
Right.
If you just look past it,
you got to
get all the whiz nugs out of there, because mm-hmm. there are many. So it's all kinds of good content in that book, but you just got to just know that you're going to be really tired of that author.
Well, here's the thing. Like, you should be able to develop an ability to not necessarily have to enjoy the person you're listening to while getting the information from them.
Yeah.
Right? And not assuming that the message is invalid because you don't like the person.
Because right. sometimes people who are assholes have some very valid points,
mm-hmm.
which is this case. Right?
Yeah, he takes every opportunity that he can to like snipe a little bit mm-hmm. at people. And it is true that I agree with basically everything that he says, but he doesn't have to say it that way.
Exactly. Right? Right. But yeah. What are other books?
He has a whole bunch of other books. That's the most recent one. It kind of is the culmination of all of them. So I don't think you need to read the other ones really. But I think that's done. So between that and then like Thinking Fast and Slow,
The Power of Habit,
mm-hmm. and then Mistakes Were Made But Not by Me, which is still mm-hmm. for me like one of my pinnacle sort of mind changing books.
Also, Thanks for the Feedback. That's a pretty good one.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
Algorithms
to Live By. Yeah, if you take those, that collection,
yeah.
right there,
and really read,
and just really read the shit out of it,
just
those.
Read it real good.
Yeah, like, you'll just be a different person.
Read the words, read between the lines,
yeah.
read the punctuations.
Do the exercises. Also, sometimes people tell me they read. I have to ask them, like, what do you mean when you say you read? Because some people, when they say
move
that,
their eyes over
they're
pages.
Like, yeah, I rub my eyes on the page. It's like, what happened? You know,
yep.
I glanced at it. Because I think if you're, especially these books, if you're not reading, if you're not engaging at the same time, then you're going to miss like 90% of the value. So have like a notebook next to you, you know, take some notes or put it in the margins.
Really read it.
Read it.
Read
Which
it.
Reading, really reading something usually means that you're actually writing also.
Yeah.
And then every now and then you stand up and you go,
You go, oh, and
then
shit.
You pace a bit.
You pace mm-hmm. and you smoke a pipe.
Yep.
And
you pour yourself some whiskey. You just kind of shake. You can make the ice cubes tinkle in there a little bit.
Then once again, you say,
yep. Yeah.
And then you sit back down. You sort of angrily scratch your chin a little bit as you're doing mm-hmm. things. You know, like kind of rub your beard really hard. You know, just there's a lot that happens in mm-hmm. close, careful reading.
Yeah. Yeah.
And assuming you have all of those things,
well, but
whiskey
if you don't,
and a beard.
Yeah. You just
a pipe.
You just tape a beard to your face for deep reading. It's just a part of that process.
It's part of the process.
Yeah.
It's part of it. You build a construction paper beard for yourself.
Yeah.
And a pipe out of cardboard.
Yep. Because you shouldn't smoke, obviously.
Which you should not. Yeah. And especially don't mm-hmm. smoke out of a cardboard pipe, because you probably
will just
will
be
die.
Fire.
Yeah. You'll probably die.
Yeah. You right. shouldn't drink either, probably, you know, so sure. just. But like apple juice looks a lot like whiskey. So
but definitely read.
Definitely read.
That's the message.
If there was any message at all.
Just but read that. Good, yeah. not bad.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from King Oz. I was thinking of starting my own podcast at my school. Me and a buddy would discuss school news, answer questions, and discuss the current haps eau de earth. I liked it.
Eau de earth. Is that a perfume?
Yeah.
No, it's like haps in all caps.
Uh-huh.
O with an apostrophe.
Ah.
Duh, D-A.
Not O earth. As in E-U, like the
yeah,
French.
So I was thinking,
earth.
French smell. Haps. Like the ground after rain.
It's Haps, you know? De Earth, but Earth is lowercase to kind of bring its ego down.
Gotcha. Yeah. Put it in its place. Blow your feet.
What do you think, and how should I start? Thanks. P.S. Sam's voice is sexy.
Ooh, hey. Hey there. How are you doing?
Calm it down,
well,
Sam.
I think it depends. Does anybody want to listen to that? That's the first question you got to ask yourself.
And the second question is, do you care if anybody wants to listen to it?
Because if the answer is the first one.
That's the first question.
That's the first one, yeah.
Yeah. Is do you care if somebody else listens?
Okay. Mm-hmm. People will listen.
Okay.
People will listen to this.
Okay.
Not in a huge broad sense, but if you're making a podcast about the things going on in your school, your classmates will they'll listen to the shit out of this.
But here's the problem.
Will they? Who will?
Well, here's the problem. Because now you have a audio record of what will probably be
the most embarrassing part of your life.
Not only that, but probably some trash talk.
Listen, we're talking.
High school's a bad time for most people.
Yeah. No, the thing about making a high school podcast is you have to keep everything positive as fuck. You cannot throw anyone under the bus.
Yep.
You cannot trash talk people.
Mm-hmm. Not even teachers. Homework aside, you're gonna be
real
careful.
And don't even think you're going to be clever and use pseudonyms.
Because here's the thing. Most high schools are run like dictatorships. This is the case where we grew up, where they're like, hey, we heard that you wrote a note to someone about blah.
And even though maybe you wrote it in your own personal cryptographic code and you used fake names.
They will bring you in and they will break you.
They will break you.
In order to crack the code.
So
I would say you can have fun doing it, but I would be very careful.
Be careful. Just be careful.
Mm-hmm. Or do it like in a veil of secrecy. That'd be fun, you know?
Oh, yeah. You should modulate all of your voices.
Ooh, yeah.
So that
use a pseudonym.
Yep.
Don't even make it talk about the different school.
But then you lose your audience. Because here's the thing. Why do people give a shit about the yearbook? Because they're in it.
Yeah,
because they're in it, right?
Also, you have that page in the back where you can like draw pictures and sign it for other people. You get your autograph book, you know?
Yeah.
It's super
important. But really, you just want them to write a note for you.
Yeah, you want to say, right. Hey, love
you.
You want to see
that all your favorite people were like, liked you enough to write a nice
people like the yearbook because it's about them. And they like having people sign their yearbook because that other people get to talk about them. Yep. This is the reason people like Twitter and Facebook and everything.
Yearbook was basically the Facebook before Facebook.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't even know if yearbooks still exist because the idea of taking pictures of people and putting it into a book seems very archaic now, actually.
But tradition, though. So probably they still
tradition. So the thing to think about with this podcast is like, you can mix in Haps de Earth, of course, but people in your school are mostly going to be excited about Haps de School.
Mm-hmm.
And actually mostly Haps o' themselves.
Haps o' themselves, right?
So you, it's a great smell.
Yeah. So you have to walk that line of throwing people that bone, you know?
Yeah. So you got to throw people onto the bus, not under it.
Yeah. Right. You got to get people on that bus.
I saw Stanley yesterday in the hall. Sweet shirt, Stanley.
Looking good, Stanley.
My man.
So-and-so got elevated to first trombone.
Dope.
Nice trombone.
Fuck tromboning.
Great work.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's how that works.
So, yeah, I guess that could work. I don't know. Yeah. I just, after all of our wrangling with administrators and schools, I just...
Yeah.
That'll
and
stick
bear
my
in
neck
mind
out.
That
yeah, I don't
when,
trust those people as far as I can throw them.
And bear in mind, if you take questions from people, people will ask questions where they try to throw other students under the bus.
Yeah,
and by answering those questions, you are now culpable as a murderer.
Mm-hmm. Basically.
Because throwing people under buses...
is a crime.
Kills them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right? So...
I don't know. Be honest. Maybe pick something not school related.
Yeah. If you did do a podcast, do it for fun to sort of cultivate your audio skills, you know, work on your quality of production, keep as far away from the school as possible in terms of topics of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe then you don't have to be so careful about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, try that. All right. Next question comes from I am Cade. What event in any game has made the biggest impact? Be it storytelling, finishing a game, or beating your best friend and rubbing it in their face.
Biggest impact on
I think my... just on the earth, sort of on society.
Like an asteroid situation.
Yeah.
I know that Pokemon Go, just in a general sense, I don't know if anybody else saw these videos, but where people were chasing a Blastoise in Central Park, there's like a herd of humans, okay, with their phones out. And someone saw Blastoise pop up like in a nearby and this mob of people hunting a Blastoise, which doesn't exist physically, goes running across the park to go.
I assume not looking at each other, just looking at their
probably
phones.
Looking at their phones.
It was and then sprinting. They all get there, and then because they're all in the same network, and they're all like moving their phones around trying to find a good signal.
Yeah,
which I think everything about that was very poetic about the just the current nature.
It's
of
almost
humanity.
It's almost an episode of Black Mirror.
Yeah,
where it's like really one inch away.
Everybody's chasing imaginary animals.
Well, but I mean, will say it was like as far as you know the last couple of years, because that was actually a big thing because my wife and I, for those two weeks. Yeah, my wife and I the first 2 days went out.
Yep.
And the thing is, we saw some other guy on the other side of the street with his phone.
Oh yeah, we saw that dude.
You make eye contact, and then you're like, you catch him.
Okay, let me ask you this, because people always talk about like you know video games have this thing, this untapped potential to sort of change the human condition. Mm-hmm. Do they though? Because I think for starters, you opt into them, right?
Sure.
So like by playing a game, you're choosing that you want to have that experience to begin with, which means you're not necessarily likely to opt into something that's going to take you really far outside your comfort zone. Right. Right. But then even events like Pokemon Go, where it was this weird cultural phenomenon, because it's tied to a product that also, you know, needs to be updated and all this other stuff. It has a shelf life.
Right.
Right. So it, like you said, it lasted for a few weeks. And at the very beginning, people were talking about how this changes everything. You know, you see, you'd go down the street and all of a sudden people are out on walks.
Mm-hmm.
People who would never leave their house for any reason other than to go to the grocery store and work.
Catch Pokemon now.
All of a sudden, they're walking down the street catching Pokemon. Mm-hmm. People are walking their dogs more. People are going to the park. People are going to parks they never even knew were there, mm-hmm. right? And then after a couple of weeks, you know, you caught all the Blastoises.
Right.
So why the fuck are you going to go to that park?
Well, I think the reality is that it's not necessarily that people are resistant to change. I think it's just change is not a particularly sticky thing. Right. And
it
wasn't a change. It was just a thing that happened.
It was an event.
Yeah. And I think that's the way to think about it because, you know, the reality is for most people, most of the time, even if you have on these big events like land in your lap, it'll change things dramatically for a very brief window of time. And then the inertia wears off. Like the momentum wears off from that thing.
It's a regression to the mean.
Yeah. We've talked about this after game jams, right?
Yeah.
There's a post jam high that lasts somewhere between like 2 and 4 days. But you have to like hold on to it as long as you can. And then it's going to go away. At some point.
Yeah, you got to set up that IV bag of 5-hour energies.
Yeah, but it is triggered by the jam itself. And I think actually, after the jam weekend, we had another jam day, I think 2 days later, because everyone was just like on it. So, you know, I think the reality is most things aren't that sticky. But, and also when it comes to other sort of gaming events that I thought were really interesting, the Twitch Plays Pokemon one again, but that whole thing was so weird and cool. To see,
it just happened.
Yeah. So I think the thing for me that's been really interesting is watching not individual games that have a single player aspect, but just sort of the weirdness that comes from having that online social aspect to games and how that sort of branches out into the real world in a much more meaningful way than like killing stuff in Dark Souls. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've been kind of interested in, which is where level heads coming in. I think we're going to have some fun with that. See what happens.
Yeah, it's easily the next Pokemon Go.
Easily, you guys.
I mean, people are going to be out in parks.
Just building
people are
going to
be out in parks building levels.
Yeah.
Downloading them and playing them. Completely mm-hmm. unrelated to the fact that they're at the park. But
yeah, but somehow it's going to encourage
There's
that.
A thing mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. It's going to be... So what it's going to be is we're going to actually create geocached levels where you can... Yeah, yeah. When you build the level...
kind of fun. You put it somewhere.
Yeah, so if you're in a park, you can publish it into the park.
Yeah, you're like, I'm going to put a level here.
I kind of like this.
That is cool.
You put a level in the park.
Well, here's the thing. Then we're going to start getting sued by people because then someone's going to be like, there's a level out in the middle of this lake and they're going to go drowned.
Because like, parents are going to sue us. Level.
Yeah, except people who have drowned can't sue you. Boom, checkmate.
Except their family can.
Not if the whole family drowned.
This is a big bust situation.
We got to make sure the game is so good
that entire
families drive into the lake.
And that's how we're going to make the world a better place through video games. I think that's the...
Yeah, I think that's right.
Just to bring it back. Yeah. You know, full circle.
You know...
What?
If you're driving a van full of children and also playing a video game, that's a bad decision
that
you have made right there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that, folks.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from Senolier... Submitted anonymously first. Oops. Any input for solo game devs trying to learn everything? I'm already a programmer. How do I balance doing that with learning enough art so that my games stop being hideous?
Mm, good word.
Yeah.
How do you do?
Good choice of hideous.
How do you do the do? I think we always think about our games as tools, so you just pick the next thing. So level heads are like, we want to learn how to do this web stuff. So how can we do that in the most fast and effective way, given what we already know? So then we just do that. And then the development of this game has a much higher focus for the three of us, and for sure on how to actually get the web stuff going. So instead of thinking like, oh, I need to learn all of these things to make what ends up being, you know, sort of a culmination game, break it down and say, okay, for my next game, I'm going to make a good looking game. And that necessarily means the mechanics are shorter.
Or keep like it mechanically. Yeah. Don't put all the emphasis on a complicated game to program. Push it in one domain at once. But what was the saying? If you chase
two rabbits, catch none.
Yes. Yeah. Don't chase two rabbits.
Like a Catholic nun or something.
Yeah, if you chase two rabbits, you're going to end up becoming a nun.
You dive in the bush and there's just a nun.
Yeah, and honestly, I think it's unlikely that any person's going to catch a rabbit, you know, just sort of athletically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're definitely less likely to catch.
But this is a lesson about scoping, right? Because it's not only to avoid chasing two rabbits, but just have a rabbit trap.
Yeah.
And just trap baby rabbits.
That's what programming is. Because they're not going anywhere.
That's what programming is.
Or get a sweet bow and arrow. Just stand there.
No, just an arrow.
They gotta move. You don't gotta move.
Because
anyway.
Arrows run real fast.
Arrows, they do. They get those little tiny legs. It's freaky. Yep.
Yeah, that's right.
But remember that you can make it an award-winning game that's beautiful with just rectangles. Mm-hmm. You know, Thomas Was Alone.
Mm-hmm.
Great, great game. Beautiful. Well done. It's just fucking rectangles.
That's true. Actually, yeah. Maybe for your first game that you want to make that isn't hideous.
Just have good colors and rectangles.
Yeah, some studying of color theory and just make it fucking beautiful with shapes and colors.
Yeah, so when people think about art, they're often like, okay, so my game's hideous right now. It needs to just look better. The problem is when you talk about art or drawing or whatever, there's a bajillion different aspects of that thing. And probably the most impactful one to start with is color.
Yeah.
So make a game that has a really good color scheme.
And shapes,
maybe, but it's just shapes.
Yeah.
Don't mess around with like trying to render a face on it.
But try to, because if you can imbue personality into something that looks good because the colors are nice and the proportions of sizes of things are nice.
And
right?
Things are squishy.
But if things are all
around.
Squishy and bouncing and they kind of convey something, if you can do that without even having a face on a thing,
yeah,
then you've now made it to that next level. Because then after that, now you can start adding faces to things, right? But if you look at our art, and including for Levelhead, we're still following the same kind of paradigm. We're just trying to make the minimum amount of complexity of art assets possible, and then do all the rest through. We only want one graphics.
Yep.
One graphics.
Because that's how we keep the price of our games.
That's the cheapest. That's right. Yeah. If you put in one graphics, then that's the cheapest cost per graphics that you're going to get.
Yep.
You know, so it just ramps up from there.
Yep.
Yeah, so I would do that. And then the other thing that I would recommend when it comes to learning art, and Sam, you could probably speak to this,
sure,
is don't assume that you know anything.
Yeah. Well, it's actually true for anything you're doing.
Yeah, but for some reason, people feel like because they can see that they know what things look
like. Yeah. Well, here's the fact. The fact
matters. Which is not true.
Yeah, and if you try to draw something, even just make a facsimile, like make a direct copy of it, just by looking at it, you will recognize that you actually don't even know how to see.
Yeah.
If you're a person who has not trained your eye to draw, you don't even know, you're not looking at things. And this is like, it's freaky, but it's a fact that, you know, you can kind of test yourself by trying to draw something that exists in front of you.
Yeah. Because. And you're going to, so instead of drawing that thing, if it's a human face, you'll draw like your caricature in your mind of what a nose looks like.
Correct.
Instead of that person's nose. Yeah.
So it's wacky. It's really weird actually to think about. But yeah, if you haven't actually done a lot of drawing before in particular or any art, make sure you look at references and look at tutorials and stuff for how to do it. That's the easiest way to do it.
Tutorials and references. Just like you would do when you're programming, you got to go to the documentation.
Right.
You know, what do functions do?
Because you think you know how a nose looks. You don't.
And you think you know what arguments this function takes, but you're also wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Next question comes from My Secret Weapon, DLC. I have a tendency to defend it as a necessary evil. The cost to develop keeps climbing, but the cost to purchase has been the same forever. Mm-hmm. Many people view it as content that should have been there from the start. What are your thoughts?
Sometimes that's true.
DLC is just a thing, just a like thing. Graphics.
Yep.
It's fine.
So, you know. Well, there's this point about the cost of purchase is being the same, but the cost to develop keeps climbing. However,
the total market has grown like a bajillion.
The market has grown dramatically, so you can... And you can distribute digitally, right? So it used to be the case that if you sold your game for $60, at best on a shelf of Best Buy, as a developer, you'd get like $4 because there's 39 middle companies that you have to go through to get it onto the shelf, right? So developers are, selling the game to the end user for the same amount, but developers are taking home a lot more money than they used to per copy. So there's that. Like Sam said, the market's enormous now. So, and you can sell infinite copies without having to print a single CD. Right.
Like a better way to think about it is there's a total value for a thing and it just gets split up among everybody who plays it.
Yeah.
It's kind of an easier way to think about it. So, you know, that with the Wu-Tang Clan had that one album they published and like they put it, there's just one copy and it's in like a silver inlaid box and they sold it for $2 million.
Right? Oh, really?
It's like, yeah, they probably could have published it and made probably about $2 million, you know? But they could
that sounds like a lot of work though.
Yeah. So they just
sell one of them.
They just auctioned it off to one person, right? And that's that.
Instead of having to print CDs and...
It's like on tour, you can go listen to it. And
can you lease it? Can you rent it for a day?
I don't know.
Probably for $100,000?
but yeah, so I think a better way to think about it is that the there's increased value in games because the market's so huge. So if you look at like Stardew Valley or something, selling just however many crazy number of copies, like Terraria is an easy example, like 22 million copies or whatever. The total value of that game then is just tremendous, right? And if you were only able to sell that to, you know, a much smaller group of people to recoup costs, you'd need the price to be higher. So the reality is that increased price now, it doesn't actually follow. It doesn't make sense to say that you have to increase the price because the games cost more to make because there's
Are those graphics.
There are those graphics that do cost more
to make. I think you have to when you're operating on enormous budgets where despite the fact that you can make way more money than you used to be able to, that you've increased your cost just to match.
Yes.
Which is true of basically any AAA title, is they've increased all of their costs across the board under the assumption that the amount of money they're going to make from that game, from that product, will match what it made the year before plus some projected increase, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're at a big AAA studio operating as a public-facing company that has shareholders to answer to, you're behaving just like a normal company does, which is that you increase your costs to match your revenue.
Right.
You get more of those graphics makers.
Yep.
So you can make more money off those graphics.
And you buy more ads.
Yeah.
Right. But so if you're a game like Grand Theft Auto 5, right? Which is, I don't even know how long it's been out now.
They just keep working.
Three or four years.
They added
4 years.
Like, but it's still one of the best selling games every quarter.
Yeah.
Everywhere. Right. So I don't know what that game is made by now, but, you know, probably billions of
dollars. I think it made almost $1 billion in its opening weekend. It made like $850 million or something.
And without a doubt, they spent a fuck ton of money on development of that game, right? But it was not $1 billion. Right.
It was only like half that.
It was half that.
Right? It was probably half that. But they've made well over what their investment was in that thing. But that's not true of all titles.
Right.
Yeah. And especially when you're constantly increasing your cost to match your projected revenue. Because it's still every launch is a gamble. If you look at the EA launches, right? Unless you have your sacred series like the FIFA and that kind of stuff that's just like guaranteed to make more money every year, no matter what you do. But outside of that, everything's just kind of a crapshoot.
Right. But I think as far as DLC goes, I mean, there's not necessarily a right or wrong approach to it as far as whether it's free, whether it's paid, because I mean, it still takes a considerable amount of effort to make it, right?
Basically, where's the incentive for the developer to make something that they're just going to give away?
Well, I think people often get most hung up about day one DLC.
Yeah.
Where if you basically say
that, I have always found a little weird.
Yeah. If you're like, here's the game and here's the expansion pack for an extra $40 or whatever.
Yeah. But I think it's a framing issue because the reality is if they just waited like 3 months and then said, oh, here's an expansion that you could buy for, like everyone would be like, cool. This is great.
Yeah.
But because it seems like, again, it's the pairing of this idea that DLC is somehow held back content. Like it was going to go in there, but you pulled it back because you're great.
Right. Is there something that the developers decided to add, then they had to spend investment time and development time on. Therefore, they need to recoup the costs of doing that.
This is actually something we talk about internally because there's a framing issue here between like a player base and the developers of a game where say there's a feature that we do want to add, but we also need to launch the damn game. If it's a feature that changes the course of or changes the gameplay for people or whatever else, and we hold off on it the question is always, should we hold off? Can we hold off on putting this in until post-launch? So that we can get the damn game out, see if it actually works, you know, because you have no idea actually if the market gives a shit.
Yeah, because if the market doesn't care, then why should you be throwing more money at?
But you also don't know if that DLC thing
would have been the thing
to help kind of, you know, kick it into gear. So there's always this really hard calculus to do as a dev on the other side, which I think, you know, the day one DLC doesn't make any sense to me, but I think when it comes to DLC later, who cares? I mean,
Yeah, honestly, like though, I don't see day one DLC as being much different than, for example, like a collector's version of a game where you get a couple extra.
But it's framing. It's all just framing.
It's framing, yeah. And, but I think, you know, this is just something that players have decided they want.
Yeah.
Right? Because if a studio says, hey, we'll sell you this for $30, like here's an extra like three maps you can play on or something for an extra $30. And then 3 million players go, fuck yeah, and they buy it.
Yeah.
Then that's just the company providing content to those players that they want and are willing to pay for.
Well, I think the reality is that for everybody's situation, you actually have a different value for a game, right? So like I might be willing to pay, say, $30 to play Terraria, but it only costs me 10, which is great for me, right? Some people might not be willing to pay even $5 for it, so they wait until it's on sale.
Some people might not be willing to pay $10. That seems like it must be cheap, but they would buy it for $20.
Right. And so actually we see this. So we launched that comic with the newsletter, right? And it's free. So you can get on Itch for free. And we can see how many people have actually paid for it. And out of the like 1,000 downloads, I think like 8 or 9 people actually gave us any money for it.
Yeah, I think 5.
Is it 5?
It's a very small.
We made like 40. we've quote unquote made $40 off of the comic. Which has certainly cost more.
Yeah, it's quote unquote because we had to, you know, spend money to have it made.
Yeah. So
which was significantly more than 40.
Yeah. So but that's one of those interesting things, right? Where you look at the point I'm trying to get to there is that comic has value for some people, right?
Yeah.
And they're willing to pay for it. And so what having something like a donation box in that particular case opens up is the ability for someone to say, hey, this is worth this much for me and I'm just going to opt in to pay you. And then when it comes to games, if there's a collector's edition and maybe I'm just really excited about that game, I'm happy to pay like an extra $20 to get something cool, you know? And so you as a business then get to capture that particular person at a different pay grade. Which is the whole idea with whales.
Yeah, I think the difference is when it feels like you've segmented your audience into like, when it feels like you've segmented the game into a part of the game and then like all the good stuff that you have to also spend another set of dollars on to get instead of it just because I think of like Fallout New Vegas had some sort of a like pre-order collector's thing, right? Where you could buy like, you got to start with like, a, shotgun. Like a shotgun.
Yeah,
you start with a shotgun and binoculars, right? It's not game changing. It helps you a little bit at the very beginning, but very minimal because you need some ammo and stuff too. Right. And what are binoculars? You know, doesn't really matter. So, but it was just this kind of fun little thing that you could get that didn't feel like it split the player base into the haves and the have nots, right? And I think that's one of the big problems with the DLC, especially for an expensive game with a lot of moving parts and a lot of really good, interesting content, is that once you start to fragment it out like that, then it feels like as a player that the audience is now fragmented and that somebody else who is another fan, like somebody who you've got camaraderie with because they're into that same thing that you're into, might be on a different plane than you now, right? Now they're just like in the real world, there are people around you who are wealthier than you. Now you go in your imaginary space.
And
where
it's
still
the case.
And it's still true, you know? It's just kind of, it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I remember WildStar had this where you could buy the collector's edition of the game and then you get this crazy looking set of gear that you can wear and this giant hoverboard that you could fly around on. Mm-hmm. And you could tell the players who had the collector's edition early on in the game, even in the low level starting zones, when you're sitting there wearing like, you know, you're like
some hideous khakis.
You're fucking wearing a rag, you know, wrapped around your neck or something as chest armor. And then somebody comes by with like these crazy glowing tubes, like flying past on their hoverboard. Yeah. I think when those things happen, when it segments the audience, I agree. I think that's.
But it's also an interesting point about the difference between something like games and like a car as a product, right? Because the reality is when you go to buy a car, you start with the base model and then you can add just like a considerable amount to get all the extra trimmings, right? And
that's DLC.
It is for DLC, your car. Day one DLC for your car.
Which I don't buy.
Well, yeah, maybe you don't buy it, but the point is it's there. A lot of people do buy it. Yep. And you're not going to complain about the fact that Jerry got a SUV that has like a better sound system.
I think people spend a lot of time. Yeah,
but
about that,
cars are not a player versus player.
I mean,
item.
But I'm
actually
I mean,
they kind of are.
It depends on the features that you can get.
But we're talking about New Vegas, like a single player game.
Single player, who cares?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
but this is the thing: is like there is some categorical difference between those two goods, right?
Yeah,
because you get pissed off about one, the other one makes sense.
Or you go to McDonald's and like, oh, you want like a slightly larger beverage.
You go supersize it for 35 cents and you're like,
they go, you know, it costs us more to give you more. So if you pay more, we'll give you more. Mm-hmm. And you're like, sure. And then a game developer does it. Well, like,
But I think it's a lot of the discrepancies because there's a huge difference between what we're doing and what a car manufacturer is doing, which is that we have effectively free infinite distribution.
Yeah.
So all of our costs are abstracted away from the end user, because our costs have to do with having made the thing in the first place and having made the decision to make it at the cost of doing something else we could have done. So right. if we make a game and we say, okay, we want to be able to add this additional content because we think it'd be really cool if players could also do X, Y, and Z, right? If we decide to do that, we're foregoing
everything else.
Making everything else, and that includes making another game. And there's nothing we could do that's more powerful for the studio, for the company, than making another game. So if we instead make basically a content expansion, then we're doing that at our cost. Yeah. We're deciding to spend money by doing that. Not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's all of our development time. And potentially even more so, because if we could have made and launched a game in that time, that would have been far more financially rewarding to us as a company than making an expansion. So by us doing that, now we're stuck with the decision of, do we do that? And if so, do we ask people to pay for it? Mm-hmm. Because to the end user, that's not any part of the calculus going. Because like when you go buy a car, I guarantee you that nobody's thinking of the development time to make the components of the car.
No.
They're buying a physical thing.
Good.
Yeah.
And they don't assume, like, you know, I got this 2010 Ford Focus, right? Now, when the 2012 model comes out,
I should get a free upgrade.
Then, yeah. Can I not just have it?
Well, but also, you know? this is something that I personally had to like recognize after a long time that I had to overcome in terms of how I looked even at physical goods when I was buying them. We're going to a restaurant and buying, you know, food that somebody has prepared. Is the sort of idea always goes through my mind, or take like an iPhone, right? Because you see people talking about this all the fucking time, where they're like, if you tally up the cost of all the parts of an iPhone, it's only like $200, but they're selling it for $1,000. You know, capitalism is evil. Whatever.
Didn't take them 3 years.
Right. Because no development cost. And I'm not saying that it's fairly priced. Sure, at all. Yeah, I have no idea. But the point is that things are not the costs of their parts. And right. I think somehow we've all been trained to believe that. And so, we believe that in the physical world, but in the physical world, we buy a physical thing. It's like we feel like we're overpaying, but we understand what has just happened. We've made a transaction. We got a good in return. Mm-hmm. There's only so many of those. There's a gatekeeper in the way. We can't just pirate it. You know, it all feels like it makes sense. But as soon as you go into the digital space, you're only paying development costs.
Yeah.
And in a little bit, you're paying for server costs if it's a web enabled game of some sort. But that again is abstracted away. Like players don't think for a second when they go play a round of Rocket League, I wonder how much server cost how much this is causing
Psyonix.
Yeah, to Psyonix, right? And of course they have infinite money. So because
I'm a developer, I think about that, which is why I used to buy every car that
they exactly.
Released.
And I did the same thing. Right.
I have to be costing them some money. Right. You know?
Right. Yeah. And so I think that's really
why I'm happy to pay for a subscription for something like Eve or World of Warcraft. Because
right.
I know.
Because you're paying for continued development of the
they've
game.
They've got a fucking warehouse of servers running 24/7 to make
it. I'm still working on it.
Yeah. They're patching it every day.
You know? You're basically paying human salaries is what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I think that distinction where when it comes to video games, you're not buying a good. That is just not what is happening. Mm-hmm. You are, and it's even strictly not that because you're licensing intellectual property. You don't own any aspect of that. There's just no sense of ownership at all between you and that thing that you're experiencing, you know? And that the idea that it's the same as buying something in the physical world is just so completely wrong, but everybody believes it so strongly that I think this is where all the difficulty comes in with everything, with the relationship between players and developers and like whether we sell content or put it out on subscription models or whatever, because to players, it's always going to feel unfair
that they have to pay for something that technically doesn't exist in the sort of tangible sense.
Right. Because when the transaction is presented as you buying something, then of course that feels unfair, right? Because you're like, this is free. Like it's free to put out. I could just have it. Like why should I have to pay $60? And like, and then the more I have to pay, the worse it is.
You could just download, no problem. Right.
Yeah. Somebody else could just send it to you. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I get that confusion, but this all comes from the fact that people still incorrectly see digital goods as basically metaphorical physical goods.
Right.
And they're just not.
Well, there's
with blockchain technology.
But with blockchain. Which is true, right? That's actually what blockchain is trying to do, is to bring digital into physical, but that's not going to...
With blockchain, you could say, I mean, you don't even fucking need blockchain. You could just say, hey, we are going to sell 20,000 copies of this collector's edition or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need blockchain to do that. You just sell 20,000.
You can just do that. But then what would that even mean? Because now you're basically saying, now you, the user, own this thing, right? So you're actually selling...
No, really, it just means you got in line at the right time to get access to a license.
Yeah, so they're just fundamentally different things. And I think the framing is the only thing that we can do, because the fact is that the way that players or consumers see buying a game is completely disconnected from the reality of the business of making games.
Correct.
There's just no relationship between those two things. And so the best that we can do as developers is just try to do stuff, try to make the best guess that given that our consumers are going to always think we're out to get them.
Mm-hmm.
And that they always think we're trying to get as much money out of them as possible. And that they think we're like actively suppressing things to get the most money, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever. We have to try to make decisions about how we're going to monetize things based on just not what the reality is of like what this business right. model is, but what our users are going to think that we're trying to do, which really sucks.
Yep.
Well, and we have to make, you know, this is a concern with Levelhead
yep.
where piracy has never been that big of a concern for us because we've made single player games. Mm-hmm. And if somebody pirates the game, we just think, well, that sucks, but
okay.
You know,
didn't cost us.
Because as long as enough people are honest and do buy the game, then
we can keep making games.
Then we can keep going, right? And so at a certain point, that threshold doesn't really matter. But I think it was just last week we ran through the numbers on Crashlands and we discovered that on Android we have about 100 pirates to every paying player,
mm-hmm.
Which means as soon as if we enable some kind of a web feature that anybody can use. Mm-hmm. Then that means our server costs are going to be 100 times what they should be yeah. in terms of paying to non-paying.
Right? Even if they're fairly low, that's
they could be 1% of that.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the other thing is I calculated out sort of some estimates for what our cost might look like for Levelhead, and but if we just multiplied that, because like it was actually quite reasonable, even if with pretty good numbers and stuff. But if we multiplied that by 100,
that's a fuckload.
That's all of a sudden really expensive, right?
Yeah.
At base, it's like, oh, that's completely affordable, not even a problem, but. Pirates. You take anything times 100 and that could start to become a problem. Yeah,
right. And so this is actually our biggest concern then going forward is trying to make sure that we develop systems not to keep people, I mean, we do need to try to keep people from cheating, mm-hmm. but the fact that because people view digital goods as just this free thing that they should just get to have,
mm-hmm.
Then now all of a sudden we might put ourselves accidentally into a position where we cripple ourselves financially because we haven't put in safeguards to keep people from ramping up our server costs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of considerations that go into yep. these kinds of things. Mm-hmm.
Really, I think the best model for it, which would never happen, I'm not even proposing we ever even try to do, but I think the most sort of reasonable financial model for this kind of a business would be more the Patreon style.
Yeah.
Right? Where a bunch of people, because that's really what's like when you buy something from us or from some other developer, what you're doing is you're saying, I like what you do and I want you to make more of that thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And I want to pay you for the time it took
to make
this one.
Yeah, right? Honestly, if I could convert, say, something like my WoW subscription into just a Blizzard subscription.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you just give them money every month and then you just know that's going into making content for you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'd have, you know, StarCraft, Diablo, yep. Overwatch, yep. blah, blah, blah. And it's just, I know they make quality stuff and they patch it and they update it and they yep. keep it fresh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would totally do that.
Yeah. And it would make developers less dependent on just the whims of trying to introduce stuff into a market and hoping for the best. And, you know, I mean, I think that would be, and then it removes the idea that like, that I have bought a game.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe this is the future of Rumpus. You know,
maybe. We'll need to have so many people in there that it won't matter.
We'll need 39 million people in Rumpus.
Probably.
We'll need the biggest backend.
Yeah.
Of any
huge,
developer.
Huge backend.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we'll also need really, really huge abs.
Yeah. You got to counterbalance it.
Yeah.
Got to keep that rumpus up.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. So we'd like to thank our producer, Fat Bard, for making us sound good. Thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. If you'd like to get more involved in the Bscotch community, you can head over to our Discord server at discord.gg/bscotch and come say hey. Also, if you'd like to adorn your body with butterscotch merch, check out our shop over at shop.bscotch.net. Or if you'd like to send us something, we have a mailbox. You can find that over at mailbox.bscotch.net. Don't send us anything living.
Mm-hmm.
We really appreciate that.
Good rule of thumb.
Yep.
Yeah, because we can't guarantee that we will get to that package in a timely manner, and it will die.
It's also very cold outside.
It's very cold. All right. Well, thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.